Crisis Radio. We apologize for the technical difficulties this afternoon, but thank you for joining us.
Still stand. Have you heard anything different as something is approaching Washington, D.C. and is about to hit the Pentagon? This testimony by Richard Clark corroborating Norman Mineta's testimony that Cheney was in command 9:15 to 9:30 in the morning when the 9/11 Commission tells us that Cheney didn't even get there until after 10 o'clock. This is a matter that needs to be investigated.
There was a question that was just asked, could we comment on NAFTA and the North American Union. And I'll start on that one because I've been campaigning against NAFTA since before it came into being. Had my own radio show at that time and had a whole series of shows in opposition to NAFTA, predicting that it would destroy the standard of living on both sides of the Rio Grande. It wasn't U.S. workers against Mexican workers. It was workers on both sides against the billionaires. And that, of course, has proved to be true. NAFTA, everyone in this country knows how far it has destroyed our standard of living and reduced wages in this country. But few people in this country understand that it is also NAFTA that destroyed the standard of living of the family farmers. We tend to call, if they're Mexicans, we call them peasants, but it's the same thing. And many others in Mexico. And it's because of that, it's one of the big reasons behind illegal immigration. Now we have an administration that has conducted a secret deal with both Mexico and Canada to form the precursor of a North American Union. And this scheme involves erasing the borders between our countries and essentially having one border around all three. It also involves the construction of a 12-lane highway from a port in a Pacific port in southern Mexico, up through Mexico, through Canada, paralleling Interstate 35 to Kansas City to a major hub to be run and owned by Mexico, and then on into Canada. This does several things. It bypasses American longshoremen, destroying their livelihood, destroying their union, and destroying their living. And it also circumvents American truckers. All of the goods from China flowing to Walmarts all over the country would be unloaded by Mexican longshoremen and taken to their destination by Mexican truckers on toll roads not owned by the United States. This is such a violation of our sovereignty, and it was done without consultation with either the people or the Congress. They did not seek the Senate's consultation. They chose not to call this a treaty. They also chose not to take it to the entire Congress. And one of the pieces of legislation, which a month ago I took to Congress, said that the North American Union is illegal, and all the studies currently ongoing must cease. No money may be spent on it, and that such agreements must have the approval of the entire
world. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. We need to thank a couple people behind the scenes who made today's symposium possible. We'd like to thank Marcy Pollan, Sue Wheaton, Elaine Sullivan, and many others. Thank you to Joe and Khalid and Matt and Aaron, many others who are too numerous to mention at the moment.
Why is it structured this way?
I've known Jim Bamford for a number of years, and I can vouch for his integrity as one of the best investigative journalists we have in the United States today. When he wrote that book, Body of Secrets, of course, he was doing extensive research into archival material. Now, the time frame given, of course, after World War II, there were quite a few Europeans who, you might say, infiltrated, or you might say were invited to join the U.S. intelligence community. Probably the most egregious was the former Gestapo chief, Reinhard Gehlen. But it didn't start with him, and it didn't end with him. And so we know that there were several British intelligence officials who became involved with U.S. intelligence and were given U.S. citizenship and became members of the U.S. intelligence community. So the fact that somebody what happened? Seems to be a problem. I mentioned NSA, and the sound system went down. All right, here we go. Say the magic word, and you get cut off. I think it's very important on Northwood, given the time frame. It was trying to generate a war with Cuba. I mean, even one of the things was they said if John Glenn's rocket failed, Cuba was going to be blamed for shooting it down. And there were plans to shoot down commercial aircraft. I would also add on commercial aircraft, Popty Bush in 1976, when he was the director of the CIA, was obviously involved in the bombing of a Cubana Airlines plane off the coast of Barbados with over 75 men, women, and children on board. Not only Cubans, but people from Venezuela, Guyana, and other countries. So the fact that the U.S. likes to talk about international terrorism, the Bush family itself and their cohorts like Gates and others have engaged in awful acts of international terrorism. A former Chilean foreign minister, Orlando Letelier, and his American assistant, Ronnie Moffitt, they had their car blown up right on Massachusetts Avenue in the middle of Embassy Row in Washington, D.C. Of course, it was Chilean agents who carried it out, but with a wink and a nod from the host intelligence service, the CIA, which was then headed by none other than Popty Bush. So if we're going to see people brought to justice for international terrorism, I echo the words of Hugo Chavez, president of Venezuela. Let us start with the Bushes, and then, let's be fair about what we consider to be terrorism, and let's bring all terrorists to justice. And if we have to get Popty Bush along with his wayward, idiotic son, let's get them all. Bring them to justice.
If I could just add a word or two, and this is Tarpley once again, concerning Northwoods. I think Northwoods was published actually in Australia before it found its way into the hands of Bamford. I'm a little bit less enthusiastic about Bamford. I think it's a critique of these institutions, but done from within them and from within their institutional logic. And I would recommend something a little bit more on the radical side. However, in terms of Northwoods, we have to say two things. First of all, if you ever told that there's no such thing as a conspiracy, by God, there is one right there, and it's proven, it's documented, and they're willing to have Americans kill Americans on American soil, and anybody who ever tells you that no American would ever kill Americans in that way, that it had to be somebody else, be they Arabs or whoever they are, this is nonsense. And the other thing is, people who say that the institutional safeguards worked and it was never done are wrong, because this is the Gulf of Tonkin incident before the fact. It was done not vis-a-vis Cuba, but an equally disastrous war in Vietnam that came out of it. And the NSA resident historian, if I don't miss my guess, a little bit more than a year ago, admitted that it was a fraud, but of course it was due to low and middle level employees who were trying to cover their incompetence in misreading the signals.
All right, our next question.
Hi. I would like to ask Webster and Dan why they think, or to go into a little more detail about why they think people like Amy Goodman and Noam Chomsky are trying to suppress the 9/11 truth movement.
Yeah, thank you for the question. That's like having the T-ball back in Little League or something. Let me just launch it off here. It's a favorite topic of mine. I should say that I used to read Noam Chomsky with much interest. I came from that side of the spectrum. I used to think that Chomsky was a great hero. I used to underline his books and thought he was just such a genius, and he was exposing so much of the paradigm. Now, we could say about Chomsky is that in August, he had an interview with David Barsimian, who's sort of his hand puppet and chief, you know, fan, the number one fan of the Noam Chomsky Club. And Chomsky came out and said the 9/11 truth is basically a conspiracy cult, that we have no proof, there's no controlled demolition, he doesn't ask about NORAD, and goes on for 20 minutes about how damaging we are, how we're destroying progressive movements. I think somebody like this is suspect. I think somebody like this is damaging the progress of progressive movements in this country, period. Chomsky doesn't just cover up on 9/11, though. He says that the CFR, Council on Foreign Relations, is a, quote, nothing organization. Well, if you believe that, you need to read a history book. You need to understand that the Council on Foreign Relations is one of the most powerful groups. A man as smart as Noam Chomsky knows this, but why does he come out and say that? Or that the Bilderberg Group is just a meeting of individuals and has no significance, and mocks the Trilateral Commission. Noam Chomsky says that JFK was assassinated by one lone assassin. And he's done this throughout history. He talks about economic oppression and the corporations, but won't tell you that the Federal Reserve is a private institution printing fiat currency and manipulating boom and bust cycles in this country. And so I think Noam Chomsky isn't just hiding the paradigm on 9/11 truth. And in fact, he goes after us as if we're doing something wrong, mocks us with spite and venom. And as far as Amy Goodman, she's had 5 years. What has she done? She had two debates. Other guests she interviews, but with 9/11 truth it becomes a debate. And she doesn't want to have on a lot of, you know, she doesn't want to have on an expert to debate Popular Mechanics guys. She wants to have on the Loose Change guys. I like the Loose Change guys. I've had Jason Burmese on my show. That's fine. But I think that the way of setting it up in a debate format is extremely suspect. We had the Alex Jones conference in Los Angeles. Reuters covered it. But Amy Goodman isn't there. Mass protest on 9/11 anniversary. Over 2,000 people with black t-shirts. 9/11 was an inside job. Where's Amy Goodman? Where's Amy Goodman to confront controlled demolition, the NORAD standard? Not a mention of this. And that is where you have to look into the foundation funding. From the Schuman Foundation, the Ford Foundation, Rockefeller, Carnegie Endowment, Soros. This is the privatized intelligence agencies. These are the finance oligarchs who give large amounts of money to these groups. And I think much of their editorial agenda is controlled. Now, as far as the people who follow them, I think that a lot of these people can be saved. I think the people who go to marches under the Answer Coalition are great people. Most of the progressives in this country want to do the right thing. Unfortunately, the intelligence agencies realize that, you know, there's going to be a lot of people in this country who ask, why is wealth distributed so unequally? Why is there war? Why is the United States going around warmongering and torturing? And so you set up these false luminaries to redirect and to show only about 10% of the paradigm. It's not that Chomsky's a liar. It's that he's only showing about 10% of what's going on. I think our strategy has to be go to the protests and pamphlet there. Go to their meetings. Go to the MoveOn.org meetup meetings and say to them, we've got a real movement going on. We're not just trying to vote for Democrats. We're trying to arrest the criminals that were behind this. Many of these people can be saved. But I think as far as the leadership, Chomsky says he gets hundreds of emails every day, and they're just venomous, and he won't listen to 9/11 truth. Somebody like that is not a friend of justice in this country.
I'm afraid Wayne Madsen is going to have to leave us now. So let me, before we go any further, I would also like to say a few words about these two charming individuals. But before I get to that, let's have Wayne Madsen give us a final statement before he presses on to another engagement.
Well, I was asked to comment on where we go from here in this Bush administration, this very Shakespearean White House we're seeing with Don Rumsfeld being thrown under the bus. Who's next? And what happened with Karl Rove? He said he was working, he was using different arithmetic or different math on the election. I think what happened with Karl was he was overwhelmed. They had targeted congressional seats. They were looking to make sure they were going to win by vote fraud or whatever means, robocalling, voter suppression, voter intimidation, the typical Karl Rove techniques. But when congressional races started to become competitive in areas that Karl never figured on, Idaho, Wyoming, New Mexico, the three seats in Nebraska, these are what Karl figured. These were safe. These are red states, you know, and they were going the other way because I think Karl was confronted with something he probably never understood, was what was once known as prairie populism. And the people, you can fool fool them some of the time, but after a while, you know, they're not going to, as Bush said, they're not going to be fooled again. Of course, he messed that all up. But anyway, so where's Carl going to go? I think there was a very important op-ed piece written in the Washington Post. Sometimes they actually have something worth reading. Very rarely, but sometimes they do. And it was an op-ed piece written about the middle of October by Sally Quinn, the former journalist for Newsweek, married to Ben Bradley, the old-time editor at the Washington Post. And it was almost as if she was channeling Donald Rumsfeld.
Please don't go away. We'll be right back. Welcome back to RBN Live, broadcasting from Arlington, Virginia. DC911Truth.org. For a full CD of today's broadcast, go online to DC911Truth.org.
I guess the allegedly elected government. You have the tenant in the White House, anyway. You have the tenant in the White House, but then you've got the Iraq Study Group that appoints the members of the cabinet, right? Robert Gates comes from them. He's telling them what to do. General Pace goes and meets with the Iraq Study Group to get his orders, what he's going to do. And then this scenario, I think it was already on election night, a lot of people were saying, think of Spiro Agnew, that the Spiro Agnew treatment is perhaps what is waiting for Cheney. But as Wayne points out, there's nothing to celebrate in this because this is all completely illegal, unconstitutional. These are indeed the machinations of the invisible government. The Iraq Study Group is a tentacle of the invisible government, and Robert Gates is an Iran-Contra felon, gun runner, drug runner, death squads, and Robert Gates is the founder of Al-Qaeda. As the CIA, as you can read in my book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror Made in USA, we discussed the creation of an international brigade of Mujahideen extremists to fight the Soviets in Afghanistan. My God, that's Al-Qaeda, even though he has a little denial that that's ever what it became. Let me also just say, concerning Amy Goodman, Noam Chomsky, their influence has been abominable, baleful. They have sabotaged the development of truth on every front. Barry Zwicker's book on the Towers of Deception, I think, is a good start, and Daniel Abramson has written about this. If we think of this awful phase that is now coming to a close, this period of 40 years of reaction and demoralization and disorientation, 1968 to 2008, prepared by the assassinations, the collapse of the student movement, the takeover of SDS by a bunch of weathermen, police agents. If we look at all these things, we'll see that Amy Goodman and Noam Chomsky are about the kind of impotent leftist opposition in name only that the foundations and indeed the Pentagon would want. Amy Goodman's story is the foundations. Noam Chomsky at MIT, that's, of course, an institution that generally figures in the top 10 Pentagon contractors in any given year, and how the money gets into his pocket is anybody's guess. He's been wrong on the Kennedy assassination. He has continued to support the bankrupt Warren Commission report, Lee Harvey Oswald, the lone assassin. This is impossible. On 9/11, he has said that there is no question that these attacks came from outside of the United States. He put himself to the right of the NATO defense ministers and NATO foreign ministers, and he writes that in his book. He is asked, what about the complicity of the CIA? And he says, I don't understand what you're talking about. What can you be saying? It was a complete surprise, says Noam, with a capital G. And then when we get to the Mearsheimer and Walt paper on the Israeli lobby, the Zionist lobby, this is a very understated, calm version of the Zionist lobby. And Mearsheimer and Walt could not get it published in any peer review journal. They got it published finally in the London Review of Books. Along comes Noam Chomsky and says, well, Israeli lobby, what is that? Everybody has a lobby. Oh, the Irish lobby, the Italian lobby, the Belgian lobby, the Luxembourg lobby. They're all lobbies. Everybody has one. No different. So this is ridiculous. And I think we've reached the point where it's enough already. It's time to go into a well-deserved retirement, time for the Bahamas, time for Tahiti. But certainly these people are a millstone around our necks, And the quicker we get an alternative to Amy Goodman and her hypocritical pretentiousness, because she's always telling you about her tremendous courage and how she's willing to take on the burning issues of our time, which generally turn out to be tertiary matters. I don't want to seem to denigrate any other issues, but when you're talking about war and peace, dictatorship and constitutional government and all the rest, 9/11 is the heart of the matter. She has sabotaged 9/11 with every breath in her body. And it's time for Amy and Noam to go gently into the night of obscurity after being in the night of obscurantism.
All right. Another question?
Thank you. I greeted this election kind of with mixed emotions because I was very happy to see the train of fascism maybe shunted off a little bit to the side. But I thought that if that happened, which it has, that we were at risk of perhaps another terrorist event in front of the 2008 election, because I felt that the people who took control of the government and have it now were not about to give up so easily. And while there may be cycles, and hopefully we're getting into a better one, I'm not so sure about that. I don't think that these people give up power easily. And I'm very concerned about another terrorist event used as a means to keep them in power. And I'd like to hear Dan Abramson and the rest of the panel's comment on that.
Yeah, thank you for the question. It's an extremely poignant one, and I think, as I said in my opening remarks for this panel, 9/11 was an inside job. We know that. We can prove it with evidence. But in terms of a forward-thinking movement, we can't stay stuck on one issue. We need to move with our time. We need to focus on what's happening right now, the intelligence situation as it stands at this moment. We have the Eisenhower Strike Group, the Expeditionary Strike Group 5, the HMT.
World Crisis Radio, streaming worldwide on the 25-meter band shortwave under the radar with Republic Broadcast Network Live. Thank you for joining us. Please don't go away. Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. We'd like to thank our panelists, Kevin Barrett, Dr. Robert Bowman, Wayne Madsen, J. Michael Springman, Daniel Abramson, Webster Topley, broadcasting live from George Mason University in Arlington, Virginia at the DC 9/11truth.org symposium.
Matter anymore. 9/11 is the vehicle with which we destroy the false flag terrorism. If we can get enough people awake, they won't be able to carry out another false attack.
All right, we have another question.
Yes, I'm Dave Schlesinger of 911courage.org. And first off, because sometimes Webster and I are at odds, I do want to praise Webster for bringing the concept of the false flag operation into the public consciousness. It's an important contribution. It may be your greatest contribution. Hopefully you'll come up with more. I want to discuss the issue of nonviolence that Webster and I do disagree with. Also, because Kevin Barrett is here, I believe he agrees with me. I will be pleading guilty and asking for the stiffest sentence, a Gandhian plea, on Monday morning for a trespass civil disobedience I did at the opening of the World Trade Center movie this past August. And in the past, Webster, you have said that you think this is an error to doing civil disobedience, and you've even said that the example of Gandhi and King, even though they're wonderful folks, is not an important example for us at this time. And I was hoping the two of you could address that.
Sure. Well, my opinion on 9/11 truth tactics is, let as many flowers bloom as possible. And I think that we're in a public education situation right now where we're pushing the tide of public opinion as hard as we can. And I think that civil disobedience is, in fact, an appropriate tactic on this issue. The reason for that is that it is a way of marshaling moral power, moral force, moral energy, and breaking matters into the public consciousness that are perhaps being suppressed from the official channels. So, yeah, while I'm not a civil disobedience fanatic, nor am I a 100% Gandhian nonviolence person. I think that among the many tactics that can be effective in the 9/11 truth movement is civil disobedience. And in fact, Mia Hamill in Tampa, Florida, created a terrific commercial for 9/11 Truth broadcast on Fox TV by getting herself arrested very carefully after bringing in the media. She did it just right. It paid off handsomely. You would have to probably spend many tens of thousands of dollars to produce a commercial that good. So I'm all for using civil disobedience for 9/11 Truth if that's your way of doing it. And I'm also for a whole lot of other tactics. Webster, what do you think?
I would simply say that times have changed, and that we're not in India dealing with a group of, let's say, extremely poor peasants with virtually no means of communication, where a public trial can be some of the most effective vehicle for making propaganda points. This was the case, say, in Europe in the 1600s or 1700s in early modern Europe. If you were put on trial, you might have your head chopped off. But like Guy Fawkes, you became quite a celebrity in the process. Nor are we in the South, the American South of the 1950s. We're here in the world that we have to deal with. And I would say a couple of things. The moral cynicism of our age is overwhelming. And many people simply do not care about somebody's sacrifice unless there's some particular reason to pay attention. I would say to people, if you're an activist today in Washington, D.C., you are worth your weight in gold, and you have got to respond to those people in the third world. Remember, 40,000 people are dying every day from starvation, malnutrition, and easily treatable diarrhea, dysentery, and things of this sort. 40,000 are dying every day. The responsibility we have to try to stop that means that we have got to use our abilities in the best and most effective possible way. And I would say to anybody, rather than get arrested for trespassing in an obscure shopping mall where you may be lucky, maybe the local paper will say something about it. Maybe they'll slander you. Maybe they won't. Maybe even Fox News. We have to remember, Fox News is now Rupert Murdoch supporting Hillary Clinton. And I've tried to point out that Hillary Clinton is running some kind of a limited hangout on 9/11. She's trying to attack Bush for not doing anything in the time leading up to 9/11 and on the day of 9/11. And we have Bill Maher saying that he wants Bush impeached for 9/11 crimes, for not doing anything. There's therefore a reason why Fox News does these things, which is maybe not your reason. I would say to somebody, if you want to reach 100,000 or a million people, you have C-SPAN, you have these right-wing radio talk show hosts, you have Air America, Ed Schultz. You can call Ed Schultz and say some things on Ed Schultz and perhaps do something to change the world in that way. You have the Internet, and you have the ability here in Washington to go downtown and leaflet it used to be able to do the Defense Department, probably not anymore. But now we can do some other places. But you can go down and leaflet Federal Triangle, and you can get a message into the heart of this worldwide imperialist bureaucracy. And I think those are the things that you ought to consider. And if you weigh that against the possible effect, world historically, of getting yourself arrested for trespassing in a shopping mall, I think this is not the best way to have people behave. I think all of our activists are absolutely precious. They are the salt of the earth. They get to be preserved. I don't want them to be bankrupt. I don't want them to be arrested. I don't want them to be in a position to be rounded up because they have a criminal record or anything of this sort. I want them to use their abilities and their energies in the most effective possible way and realize that they are individuals of inestimable value who are worth, let's say, a division. In other words, one activist in Washington, D.C. is worth a division in India or China. In other words, 10 or 20,000 activists. Huh? Get the point? Huh? No, it's because of where you are. It's not, you can be black. You can be Chinese. You can be anything you want. But the point is, you're here in Washington, and you can strike at the heart of this imperialist creation, whereas the other people can't. And I think that's something you've got to consider.
Okay, do we have another question?
This question is for Dan Abramson and Wester Tarpley. The United States decides to go into to attack Iran. Could you please speak to the missile capability of Iran, the missile range, and the type of missiles, and what kind of damage they can do to our Navy if we do plan to attack them?
Yeah, sure. I've covered a lot of the war games that Iran has been running. Let me go forward and then backward. We just are ending today the Great Profit 2 war games. And as I stated, China has been selling Iran the C-701 and the C-802 missile systems, as well as the Shahab 3 missile system, which explodes and then breaks up into about 10 small bomblets. As the Debka file, and that's basically privatized Mossad, reported, this has a 2,000-kilometer range, meaning they can hit Europe and Israel. So the range of Iranian missiles probably can't hit this country. But what they can do is mine the Straits of Hormuz, and that is where large portions of Middle Eastern oil come out of, and as well as Nigerian oil and parts of Africa. And so by shutting down the Straits of Hormuz, the Russian paper Kommersant reported that oil would probably go to $200 a barrel. Others have suggested $150. Barrel. This will create a world crisis situation. And, you know, Dick Cheney had said that they wanted $100 a barrel oil. A lot of this is done to keep the dollar propped up. But if they go after Iran, look for the Straits of Hormuz to be shut down. How do I know this? Iran in April was running war games, stressing naval area denial. What they're planning to do is block any ships from coming in, and that's why you have minesweepers now that the United States is sending in. They don't want minesweepers for landlocked Afghanistan. They certainly don't want minesweepers for the tiny little piece of water that surrounds the Iraqi border. Minesweepers are there for Iran to open up the Straits of Hormuz, and so that's the damage that they can do economically. As far as the real missile systems that will hurt us, then we're looking at Russia and China. The United States is taking a huge gamble if they invade, saying basically, we dare Vladimir Putin, we dare the Chinese to take a response if we attack. China with their $250 billion worth of oil and gas deals. Russia and all the hundreds of scientists who will be killed in the reactors. Russia who has oil and gas deals as well as security deals in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. The United States is saying, we dare you to counterattack. But if that bet goes wrong, if they dare them and it doesn't go well, then you're going to see intercontinental ballistic missiles going, and that's basically the end of the planet. And so the war with Iran, we have to think of it in a different context. This is not Iraq over again. This is not a colonial occupation. This is going to potentially be the end of the planet, and we need to fight it in that way with that kind of vigilance. That's why I say, call the radio stations, do one thing a day, hand out one pamphlet a day, make one radio call a day, do one thing so you can say that you're not just talking to the same people. Don't just keep talking to your same friends or your same family, trying to convince the same people every day about the same facts. Go out there and convince somebody new. And certainly the radio station idea is one of the best. But as far as the missile capabilities, Iran cannot hit us. And one more thing I have to say, there is no nuclear weapons program as far as anyone can tell. The Mossad, the psychopaths there say it's 2 to 3 years away. Military intelligence sources in the United States, 5 to 6 years. The think tanks say 4 to 6. CIA and State Department, 9 years away. And so when they talk about this nuclear Iranian threat, it's mythology. The same mythology that Condoleezza Rice was pushing, saying that a mushroom cloud would hit us from Iraq. It's a joke. It has far more to deal with the pipelines, with the Iranian oil bourse, with the preservation of the petrodollar, and with the end game against Russia and China.
Let me just add one further aspect, which I think I tried to sum it up today, but for the radio audience, let me try to repeat it. If there is war with Iran, the 140,000 U.S. forces in Iraq are in an extremely critical position. They might well face encirclement and annihilation. They might be wiped out. They might face this even if the war with Iran does not occur anytime in the near future. Let me just cite the following three sources and then comment a little bit about them. The first is William S. Lind. It's called The Third and Final Act. You can find it at antiwar.com. In that article, he also cites a column by Georgie Ann Geyer, syndicated columnist. There's also on Uruknet and other places a report from the journalist Alexander Cockburn. I think it's pronounced Coburn, but written Cockburn. He reports from northern Iraq, and he talks about questions of encirclement. Now, without trying to attribute which fact to which one of these, let me just say the following. Since about July, the U.S. commanders have very unwisely chosen to concentrate all their forces in the city of Baghdad. And what they've done is to leave exposed their supply lines. And above all, their supply line is a 400-mile shooting gallery that goes from Kuwait and Basra in the south up the Tigris-Euphrates corridor to Baghdad. It's a single road, and it goes through towns. It goes through the cities. The reports are that what the U.S. calls Sunni militias, but it really means Ba'athist nationalist resistance forces, are systematically encircling Baghdad. They're closing the ring, starting from the west, extending around to the north, and also attempting to extend around to the south. There is a very grave danger that the U.S. forces in Baghdad, the majority, will be pocketed. They will be cut off, encircled. They will have their supply line cut. They will not be able to get ammunition and, above all, fuel. Reports are that food is becoming scarce in many neighborhoods of Baghdad. Bread and watermelon are the diet for many of the residents of Baghdad. As this goes on, it's perfectly feasible that this ring will be closed. Now, you have to remember what I've called the Sicilian Vespers. In other words, a kind of people's war, a kind of uprising where everybody fights the whole time until a decision is reached. Think of that movie Black Hawk Down. Think about the horrors of that shooting gallery all the way up that 400-mile supply line, all the way around the ring of around Baghdad. Everybody knows that Anbar province is completely under the control of nationalist resistance fighters. That goes for that road from Amman, Jordan, to Baghdad. That is now being extended, and the entire 400-mile supply line to Basra in Kuwait is under the control of the Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr. If there's a war with Iran, that line will be cut. And even without a war with Iran, the Sunni, or again, Ba'athist nationalist resistance forces may well cut it. It would seem that the U.S. command is blinded by their racism and by their psychosis of invincibility. According to William S. Lind, there's not somebody there with the intelligence to say, my God, we're being encircled. This is what happened to the British in Afghanistan in the 1840s. It's what happened to the British at Khartoum in the Sudan in the 1880s. Two armies wiped out. The Italians went into Ethiopia in the 1880s. They were wiped out. The British went into Iraq. They were surrounded and annihilated at Kut. The French at Dien Bien Phu, the most recent example. All with this racist contempt for the capabilities of a very, very formidable and determined adversary. People say support the troops. The only way you support the troops is to get them out immediately. They're facing encirclement. They're facing real military defeat in a way that these people cannot imagine. It's also clear that the Committee for Public Safety, the Iraq Study Group, says, oh, we'll take our time. We'll issue our report on December 7th. Five or ten people are getting killed every day just on the U.S. side, to say nothing of the hundreds on the other side. How in God's name can they delay delivering some kind of a policy change, especially when the ring is closing around Baghdad and they've got to see this fact? Now, in June, a group of 12 Sunni resistance groups, and these are some of the toughest and most effective, said, we'd be glad to stop all military operations if the U.S. would simply pledge to get out within 2 years. Why in God's name has that offer not been accepted? That's what's got to be accepted. And the Baker-Hamilton Commission has got to, well, if they're the government now, which is something I don't like, but if that is the government, the way it looks, that they've taken over from the bankrupt Bush administration, little Bush is now in receivership and Baker-Hamilton and Gates are running the government. If the Iraqi study group is now the government of the United States, then they have got to step forward and accept that offer and also bring in Syria and Iran. Of course, the trick there is Syria will join it if they give the Golan back to Syria. The Israelis do. And the price for both of them is the creation of a real, independent, viable Palestinian state. But in the meantime, if you care about those U.S. forces, get them out immediately, urgently, for God's sake.
I think one of our best hopes is to have an international truth commission. I mentioned in my speech that you have the leaders of Iran, Russia, Venezuela all coming out and saying explicitly 9/11 was an inside job. There is your basis for an international truth commission. You have governments that are willing to come out and examine the evidence. We know that we can work with foreign governments who will not have the same allegiance the invisible government controls. I think that's the best hope right now. And in the meantime, we need to keep the focus on exposing 9/11 as a vehicle for stopping the war with Iran.
We'd like to thank the DC 9/11 Truth.org organization. Please contact them for a full CD of today's broadcast for a modest fee. And thank you to our host.